So metta. The second to last parami, these perfections. So the paramis, if you're just joining us, are these qualities that the way they say is that the Buddha actually spent lifetimes perfecting each of these to the point where he was kind of ripe enough to fully awaken. So that's one of the ways we use these paramis, is to practice toward awakening, to practice developing these qualities. And each of these paramis, we also have to notice that tendency to want to attain or strive toward and let the deeper qualities come forth. So metta, often translated as loving kindness, but can also think of it as this quality of friendliness, this quality of being toward or next to, this kind of this warmth of heart. Because sometimes we think of loving kindness and that word love kind of trips us up a little bit. Christina Feldman would often talk about it as just this willingness to sit next to experience, an inner experience or external experience. And metta is one of those practices that originally was really this, the way we did actually did in the meditation, this emanating in the forward direction, the backward direction. There wasn't so much the phrases the way that we usually think of them today. That came a little later. But both are powerful practices. And so you can kind of play with using a particular phrases like may you be safe, may you be peaceful, may you live with ease. Or you can have this quality of just this basic friendliness, almost emanating forward, emanating back. And it's really helpful to kind of imbue it into the very meditation practice itself. So as you're meeting the breath, as you're making the sensation, to meet with this quality of friendliness, this quality of allowance. Now, metta also was one of the antidotes to fear. And that's what I want to focus on tonight. How metta can be a way to work with our fear, or you can almost think of anger as the opposite side of fear, anxiety, to start to bring this quality forth when this comes up in our lives. A short thing I read last, I think it was last week, from Thomas Merton, that when prayer and love are learned in the hour, when prayer becomes impossible and the heart is turned to stone. You know, when our hearts are so closed, when there's so much fear, it feels like we can't really learn to love. We can't really learn to have prayer or to, in our words, to meditate. But we can learn it in a deeper way. And I shared this story, I think also 2 weeks ago, and I know I just shared it in the intro class last week, but it's a powerful story from my own practice around metta and around this antidote to fear. So that line in the poem that I just read at the end of the meditation, the loving or the kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye, that was a poem that my teacher Rodney Smith used to read every retreat. You know, when I was the first 5-10 years, I just heard that every retreat, and I just kind of lit it. And if you've ever been on a meditation retreat, a silent retreat, you became very receptive. You became very open to experience. And so hearing these words kind of wash over me, you know, weeks, months and months after time, years after year. So that loving kindness, there's that phrase that before you know what kindness really is, you must know loose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved. All this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. So hearing this phrase over and over again, or this poem, kind of it's sunk in. And then one day, my wife had this emergency happen, and we had to go to the ER. And it was a type of emergency that there was a lot of unknowns about how things would go, a lot of difficulty. And this phrase came to mind because at that time our daughter was only 3 or 4 months old. And so there's this idea of what the future will hold. And that poem had a different meaning in that time. It's like to feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth, what I counted and carefully saved. You know, having that all fall away, the projection into the future, what the future holds or could hold, to feel how tentative it could be, how tenuous, how fragile it could be. I mean, luckily things worked out fine in the end, but in the moment there was a lot of uncertainty around it, a lot of fear around what would happen, what it would mean for her, her health, for my own love for her, for the our health of our young daughter. And so there's a lot of fear that came up. And as I shared a couple weeks ago, I tried to meditate in that space. But that meditation, it just didn't feel like I could get any kind of purchase on it. Like the breath was just not accessible. There was so much fear, so much trauma in that situation, the meditation just would not catch, would not touch, would not land. And then I started to practice some metta. So metta, the way I practiced it then, was these simple phrases. May you be safe and protected, starting with directing it toward my wife. May you be healthy. May you live with ease. May this, and this is really helped me connect with this experience, to actually be present in a way I wasn't able to, toward myself, to the caregivers, the people at the hospital. And in this way, metta became this refuge, this way of meeting the fear, an antidote to fear. In the Metta Sutta, it's one of the famous suttas, and we'll kind of use this talk to explore this line by line. But one of the backgrounds or backdrops to the Metta Sutta is that there was a group of monks that were going to practice in this part of the woods that was inhabited by spirits, right? And the spirits didn't really appreciate the monks being there. They were mischievous. They were scaring them. They were kind of terrifying. And if you ever had any encounters with spirits, you know how scary they can be. They can just get in you. They kind of get you to a visceral level. And so the monks ran back to the Buddha and said, "We can't keep meditating in this grove. It's scary. It's too scary in there. They're really trying to scare us, and they are scary." And the Buddha realized that there wasn't actual danger, it was much more of this psychological danger. And this, he realized, okay, this is a chance for them to learn to turn toward that fear, to open to it. So he suggested they go back. Again, they came back terrified. So finally he brought forth this practice of metta, this metta to help focus on compassion, to focus on friendliness of heart, to turn toward the difficult, by having this quality of metta to lead with that. And it became this antidote for fear. And they're able to sit in that hall, in that grove of trees, and the spirits actually started to relax with the metta. Because fear has an interesting quality that when we're feeling fearful, it tends to be contagious. Other people start to feel that also. If you're angry, people start to feel that. There's this echoes that go back and forth. And with metta, it goes the opposite direction. It starts to calm the system, the whole system of the people around you. There's I think I read or heard about a study anyway, that places and cities where there were meditators, there actually was a decrease in crime. That somehow that would just spread out through, not with any particular actions other than people just being willing to practice, being willing to meet their own experience. So this sutta, and this is one of the parts of the homework, is to look up this sutta and to read it and to reflect upon it, to see what comes up. I'll share my own reflections around it, but I encourage you to find your own meaning with it. So it's called the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Buddha's words on loving kindness. So this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited. Right? Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech. Now the paramis, remember we had truthfulness, we had ethics as another parami, and these start to transform the way we actually are in the world. That if we have a contraction of heart, we're lying, we're deceiving, we're distorting the truth, it's much harder to have access to metta. I think that's one of the messages is learn how can we start to use all these paramis together to support each other, to support our own openness of heart. Humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Right? So looking at some of the ethics or the precepts of greed and hatred, how to live from a place of generosity, of not stealing. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. Not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Right? So that's actually quite a big set of requirements there. I think the Buddha was pointing toward that, you know, assuming that we basically have a level of ethical behavior, that our ethics are fairly well lined up, we can still have fear that comes up. We can still have fear around people judging ourselves. Sometimes it's these deep patterns we learned as children, you know, being inadequate, being fearful of judgment, all those qualities. We start to always anticipate that quality of fear. And so the Buddha was pointing toward actually notice your own ethics. Notice your kindness of heart. Notice how you actually live a life that's not causing harm. And to let that in, to really let that sink in. Remember Joseph Goldstein was on a retreat in his early days. And he was practicing. He was kind of coming up with all this kind of self-dislike, this self-loathing. And his teacher, trying to be compassionate, said, okay, go to your room and reflect on your ethical conduct. All right, so he went to his room and, of course, reflected on all the things he had ever stolen or lied about, all the things he hadn't done well. But the teacher really wanted him to focus on all the good that he was doing, all the kindness he had done to help brighten his mind, to brighten his heart. So it's this Western mind is tricky, isn't it? It likes to kind of go into these patterns of self-dislike. And this is one of the deeper ones, one of these almost fetters that keep us tied into this cycle of suffering, right? And this is kind of, often we come push to shove, that's what we most deeply believe about ourselves, that there's something inherently inadequate about ourselves, right? And with that belief, that ties us to the cycle of samsara, of suffering. It reinforces that sense of I, of me. Something to defend, something to hide, something to feel ashamed about, to feel guilty about. My own practice, that was something that I had to learn to open to and work with very early on, because I would start to practice and meditate. And the practice actually started to bring that up in a more highlighted form because I could see it more clearly. Instead of being so kind of caught in acting out from it, I was able to step back to observe it, to actually see it, to see the patterns of mind. And it was a little bit maybe horrifying, is maybe not too strong of a word, but wow, this is a really pervasive pattern. And how do I work with it? How do I open with it? I remember a big change, big turning point for myself in this was I was doing a Dharma dialogue with my teacher, and he used to do these things. He would call them Dharma dialogue. So a person would ask a question and he would basically ask them questions back and help them guide deeper and deeper into their experience. And so I asked him about what I do with this inadequacy, this self-loathing. And he said, okay, open to it and just do nothing with it. So I'd open to it and see, he guided me into seeing the beliefs around it. And at some point, I just got to this really quiet place that it wasn't so charged. I could see it as a belief. And then what do I do with that? He said, just be with it. Don't try to do anything with it. And so that started me off on this whole process of, it became a theme in my practice for a few years, really, is to notice how that colored the way I perceived the world, the way I interpreted the world, dependent origination, this is the way we change perception based on our conditioning. Right? Because we, each one of us, we can have the same exact experience, but we're going to have a very different interpretation. Different interpretation based on our history, our upbringing, our experiences, our trauma, all these things shape the way we perceive the exact same thing. Right? So I start to notice, wow, I would hear a phone ring, and I would think, okay, someone, there's a little part of me that thought, oh, someone's calling to criticize me. I would open the mailbox and notice I was anticipating some kind of rejection. And so by noticing it without trying to change it or alter it, but just to really open to it in a deep way, eventually I started to see it was just another belief that wasn't actually true. It was just a thought that I thought made sense, helped me make sense of things. But I can eventually see the emptiness of that. And there's a lot of freedom in that moment. And that helped to loosen this belief in self. Because that's such a bedrock piece. So when the Buddha is saying this, to really not be proud, to be not humble and conceited, unburdened with, be upright, all these different qualities, I think as Westerners, we also need to have a willingness to turn toward and really question these deeper beliefs of who we take ourselves to be. Because perhaps in other cultures, it's enough to, they have their own conditioning they have to work on, their own barriers to practice. But this is kind of almost a fundamental one for us. And that quality of the way I described working with it, opening to it, had metta built into it. Notice this area of pain, noticing this area of contraction without trying to change it or alter it, but to notice in a very clear, direct way. That definition is sitting next to, being willing to be in approximation to open to this, to acknowledge this. Now, metta is one of those Brahma-viharas, those divine abodes. And it's said that that's the primary one that transforms based on whatever it touches. So if it's touching just someone who's just hanging out, there's a quality of metta. If that person is suffering, it transforms into compassion. If that person is having success and joy in their life, it changes to sympathetic joy. And equanimity is this other Brahma-vihara that helps to balance that. So this Sharon calls it the secret ingredient. So not proud or demanding in nature, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise or later reprove. Right? So this is this, I think to get to this point, we often have to go through this kind of loosening this belief of self-hatred, of inadequacy for many of us. But then start to reflect how this starts to brighten the mind, starts to brighten the heart. It's like, oh, my actions are actually upright. They're actually based in kindness. They're based in non-harm. To take the way that teacher for Joseph Goldstein really meant them is to reflect on what you are doing well in your life and good in your life and let that brighten the heart, brighten the mind. This is really essential for us because you know, there's been a lot of research or talk around this negativity bias that we have. So I talked about kind of this internal one. We also have a negativity or bias just in the world, right? Our evolutionarily preferenced if we were a little bit more paranoid and worried, right? If we're worried about a rustle in the woods, okay, is that a Kodiak bear or is that a tiger or whatever it might be? And if I reacted with fear from that, I might be able to run away faster. But if I was like, oh, that's just probably a butterfly, a little squirrel. You know, sometimes it really was a bear and my ancestors couldn't pass on their genes, right? So that's kind of built into the way we perceive the world. And if you look at the news, what ratio of news do you read is positive and joyous and happy versus how much of it is fearful and scary and elicits that. There's this strong bias toward that, and it's really built into the very way we perceive things. So one of the things that helps metta actually take root is this brightening of the heart. Sometimes I like to start with generosity, or not so much generosity, but gratitude, appreciation, to reflecting upon that in your life. That starts to soften the heart, helps to incline the heart toward metta. All right, so we start to get these conditions here to allow metta to come forth. So then wishing in gladness and in safety, is continuing with the Metta Sutta. In gladness and safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, admitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings live at ease. May all beings be at ease. So this wishing, this is an interesting translation of this, of metta, because it is a wish. It's like, may you be safe. May you be protected. May you live with ease. But often our wishes are a little bit conditional, right? Okay, I wish you to be happy. I wish you to stop bugging me, is what we're kind of really saying. I want you to be a nicer person. So there's a conditional quality, and we say, I've been offering you metta. Are you not happier now? Why are you still stuck in your patterns? So metta has this unconditional quality. It's like this offering without any strings attached. It's like this freely offered gift. And so if you notice that, that's kind of one of the sticky parts of metta, is that we have this conditionality. I want this person to change, right? Versus allowing them to be just how they are. Just how they are is, I think, is much more akin to what metta really is. And when you do metta, I've noticed this, many times when I've offered metta to different particular individuals in my life, and that's how the formal practice is often suggested. You actually pick out a person who's maybe a neutral person or a benefactor or a friend or even a difficult person, and you can intentionally offer metta to these different categories. By doing that, and I would encounter that person in life, I would notice there would be a different way of relating to them. There'd be a way of my being closer, feeling more open, more receptive, really more connected to them as a human being. And this is one of the teachings of metta, and you see it in this line. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they're weak or strong, admitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Okay, so this is starting to tell us we need to shift from our normal way of thinking about other people. Right? Because you think if you sit in a room, you might sit and look at all the people, okay, I like those people and I don't like those people, or those people I get reactive to, or whatever it might be. If we read the news and we hear about categories of people or things that people are doing, very terrible things, can we start to kind of transcend all those differences? It's not about excusing them. It's not about trying to whitewash that. But it's really about kind of seeing the essence of those beings. This is difficult. It is hard to do, but it's also one of the big teachers of this. That's why if you're ever on doing a practice of formal metta over a few days or weeks or months, by the way, Narayan and I will be offering a month-long on the Brahma Viharas next April in the Forest Refuge. So consider that if you resonate with that, to really dive into these. But you go through these different categories. You go through the self toward, metta toward yourself, toward the benefactor, someone who's really supported you, to our friend, to someone who you feel just neutral about. You don't really notice them. Don't really elicit any kind of liking or disliking. And the difficult person, or even the enemy. Now, this categories, it's interesting because it's often said to start with the most easy being possible. And in the traditions, the way they came from the East, it was the self. Okay, because they thought, okay, the self's got to be the easiest person. But that's not so much the case here in the West. Sometimes it's the hardest person. You know, so we learn to kind of tweak it, to work with this pattern. There's a test of someone's metta practice that Sharon Salzberg shared that's traditional, that you, I think it's from the Visuddhimagga. But anyway, so you're asked this scenario. After you've been doing metta for a while, you're walking through the woods, and you've got your best friend, dearest friend on the one side, and your most hated enemy on the other side. And this bandit jumps out and says, okay, I'm going to kill one of you, but lucky you, you get to decide who it's going to be. And, you know, usually we think, okay, here's a chance to kind of get rid of my enemy, right? Or maybe I'll martyr myself, or I'll protect my friend. But if you really practiced metta, and as Sharon had done, she couldn't distinguish between the three categories. In other words, she perceived the essence of herself, her dear friend, and the enemy as all the same. There's no distinction. Right? So this is what metta starts to ask us to do. And this is where sometimes our minds get tripped up. Like, I can't offer metta to that person I just can't stand, that just, you know, I just can't understand how unskillful they are in my life or in the bigger scheme of life. See if you can transcend those differences to go into the essence of who they are. Because just how you want to be happy, so too they. You know, may it be true happiness, not the happiness based in greed or in hatred, but the happiness that comes from wisdom, from deep understanding. So may all beings live, be at ease. And with metta, we sometimes go through the different categories, like I just said. Sometimes we go through different, functionalities, like all the creatures who walk on two legs, other creatures who walk on four legs, on multiple legs, other creatures who fly, other creatures who have no legs and crawl. So you kind of go through very systematically this whole, basically all sentient beings. And moving on with the sutta, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Right? Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Okay, so metta, we can see, is this opposite force of anger. Opposite force of deceit. Right? So you can see how the parami start to work together. That parami of truthfulness, the parami of generosity, the parami of ethical behavior, all those start to come together to help us to really express this quality of metta. Now, sometimes with metta or this practice in general, we get a sense of it's a passive process because we emphasize so much of this meeting experience just how it is without changing it. And that's really meant to, how do you meet this moment how it is? And in that meeting of this moment, that becomes this launching pad or this springboard into wise action. So that in this next line, that even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. So that sense of protection, that those of us who are our parents or grandparents, you know how we would almost give our lives for our children. We would have such courage will come up that we wouldn't have for ourselves, we'll bring it forth to protect our children. And so the Buddha is saying that kind of courage is also an aspect of metta. So on my right here, we have the statue of Kuan Yin, who is kind of a depiction of the Buddhist god of compassion, It's really considered in other ways, another aspect of the Buddha, but this quality of compassion. And she is often portrayed in different postures. So here's a posture of repose. And actually this statue on my other side, I'll turn that line so you can see a little bit better. This Buddha actually has one leg down, one leg seated, which is interesting. This is actually more of the royal repose pose that we often see Kuan Yin is, that she has one leg folded, one leg ready, so like she can get up to act in the world. And I like this pose from the Buddha. It's like, here we are in daily life, we're sitting, but we also are ready to act, to come into the world, to engage. But another depiction of Kuan Yin is that of a warrior. So it could have this quality of this protectiveness. Even as a mother protects with her life, her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart, one should cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upward toward the skies and downward toward the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. Right? So this is this quality of a wordless metta, going all directions. Now this is a powerful practice. In my teacher training, I had teachers like Joseph Goldstein. And I remember we were teaching, me and a team, three of us, were asked to teach metta to, you know, these senior teachers. And we did this radiating quality. So we had Joseph Goldstein and Carol Wilson and Guy Armstrong and all my fellow trainees. And when we had them say, offer in the forward direction, it felt like this palpable wind coming toward me, this force coming toward me, kind of washing over me as they all offered metta in the forward direction. So let your metta be like that, this powerful movement across the landscape. So with a boundless heart, one should cherish all living beings, not just the ones we like, the ones we know. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downward to the depths, outward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. So walking metta, for I don't know how many old timers, how many people were here with Sims when Sharon Salzberg used to come every year? So she would often have us do walking meditation, but do metta as we did that. And it was a lovely practice to go walking, offering metta. You see a stranger, you see a cat, you see a dog, you see a bumblebee, may you be saved. May you protect. You said it to yourself. At least I did. And you just walked at a normal. She always encouraged us to blend in with the locals, you know, to kind of feel like you're part of the surroundings. But it's kind of this covert metta. You can stand in a grocery line, you know, offering metta to those people around you. Free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. Okay, this is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed of all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, the divine abode. By not holding to fixed views. Okay, fixed views are like when we, like I talked about that deep view of self-inadequacy, that's a fixed view. Prejudice, biases, all these things are fixed views, opinions. Okay, we hold those. We use them, you know, we have a views and opinions, helps us navigate the world. But when they become fixed, when we take that as being absolutely true, that's when they become a problem. So not holding to fixed views. The pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So that might sound like a bad thing, but that's actually a good thing from the Buddhist perspective. Because from a Buddhist perspective, there's this cycle of rebirth. And you can believe that or not believe it. We don't have any requirements to do that. But there's a way that we're always reborn moment to moment, right? And when we get reborn, sometimes we find that our habits lead to more suffering. Sometimes they lead to less suffering. Same thing with the bigger rebirths, if you take that cosmology as being true. But being not born into this world means that there's this, even in this lifetime, this human lifetime, there is this freedom as the self falls away. There's this connection to all things that stops being a concept or an idea, but a direct knowing. It's like it's coming home again. So this way, metta takes us in all the way. All right, can we just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle? This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise will later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease, whether living beings or may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon the other. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downward to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. All right, so we have a chance to hear from you about your thoughts or your sharing around metta or questions you might have. I'll respond the best I can. And I want to just quickly go over the homework. So I put that in the chat for those online and those in person. There's some copies back by the Donna Baskets. So first aspect is to read and reflect upon the Karaniya Metta Sutta this week. So you can just type that in. Access to Insight is one of my favorite ones to go to, and I saw that Malia put that into the chat for those online, a link to that. But practice, here's the root of it. Practice metta when you're feeling angry, fearful, or anxious. Actually call that forth. You have some way of dealing with anger and fear and anxiety, right? It might be functional, might not be so functional, but try seeing if metta works. This is what the Buddha gave those fearful monks. He said that, he gave that sutta and sent them back in to the forest. And try different forms of metta. You know, it might be a metta that you're saying the phrases like, may I be safe, may I be safe, may I be safe, may I be protected, may I be protected, may I live with ease. You know, I often like to hold one of the phrases until I feel something shift. Like there's something shifts in my relationship to what I'm focusing on or dealing with. My heart opens in some way, and then go to the next phrase. It might be metta. Maybe you have a job or something in your life that you're offering something. So have that metta, say a metta phrase as you do that. I mean, you can do it completely covertly, secret, you know, just say, okay, may you be safe as you offer this, as you receive something. Try the different phrases or for wordless quality. Try offering metta to other beings and toward oneself. And see what's beneficial. Can I get some experience around this? The more experience you have, when you see it actually does help you, it helps ease that contraction of heart. You're going to have a deeper understanding of the practice, a deeper embodiment of the practice. And what do you notice? Next week, we'll have a chance to do some small group dialogue around this. So are there any questions or sharing in the room or online? Online, you can just raise your virtual hand and I'll call on you. And here in the room, you can raise your physical hand and grab a mic. Yes, Charles over here.
Thank you for that talk. When you started reciting the sutta, my mind lit up with some recognition. I think my friends here who frequent Clear Mountain Monastery regularly, mm-hmm. That's one of the chants that often gets recited in the yes. morning at the beginning. So it was really cool to hear that again and hear your perspective on it. So just thank you for that.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's definitely one of the more important suttas or chants to have, and it does, if you do that on a daily basis, it starts to really transform you. It starts to get into you. And of course, the chanting of it also has that nice, the rhythm of that. Anyone else? Yes. She's going to let her get the mic so they can hear you online.
You kind of answered this, but I'm wondering how your ego doesn't come in, because, you know, like I pass someone who's unhoused and I say metta, but then I'm no superior to that person. I don't want to, right? I mean, so I don't want to feel like I'm pitting somebody because they're equal to me. So I guess I get into that in my head, like, oh, I don't, like, by doing that, am I just feeding my ego? And I don't know. So and you said to equally do it no matter what. Yeah. So anyway,
No, it's a great question. And I think it's one of those things that does come up with metta, is that we can... And especially if we're paying attention and you're really open to whatever's arising, you know, I think in 2 weeks I'll be exploring kind of the shadow side of metta, not really the shadow side of metta, but how when we basically try to make ourselves or pretend that we're being more metta oriented than we really are, we're trying to be this kind of persona of being kind, but really underneath we're not feeling kind, or there's some of these other qualities. So I think that would be my second talk to kind of flesh that out. But what I offer is that Christina Feldman kind of developed this kind of hybrid approach to metta. So that you're offering metta and you start to notice just what you noticed. Okay, there's this little bit of pity, or this sense of, okay, I'm glad I'm, you know, maybe I'm repulsed, or maybe I'm better than that person, even though we're trying to act, you know, after the metta. What she suggested, you know, one option is just to keep offering the metta and just kind of let that purify it through the repetitions. But she suggested actually switching to insight practice at that point. Because what that does is it's giving you some valuable information. You're noticing, oh, there's this contraction. What doesn't help is to kind of deny that or push it down or put it under the rug, all those, you know, because that just makes it come out in a stronger way, which we'll have another fun sutta to explore in a couple weeks. But that doesn't work so well. It's really you're denying a part of yourself. You're really kind of saying, okay, I'm judging this part of me that's pitying or that's feeling superior. So instead, if you say, okay, I'm going to move to the insight practice, let me notice that how this is an embodied experience of feeling conceit or arrogance or being better than. If I can start to notice it without judging it, that starts to loosen it up. Because there's this tremendous power in this practice of simply, when you see something clearly without altering, without trying to change it, that in itself starts to change the system. This is tricky because we're so used to seeing in order to change it. I'm going to figure out what I'm judging and then I'm going to fix it, get rid of it. I'm going to give me the, you know, three ways or five ways to make myself a better person. You know, all those kind of, that's embedded in our society. But if you had this, okay, I'm going to completely allow that this is present in me and open to it. Doesn't mean I'm going to act from it, but I'm going to actually get to know it. So we have to be willing to open to our shame or guilt around it. We have to be willing to open to our argument that, you know, I justify that kind of quality. So what I would suggest is doing that. When that gets elicited, okay, I'm going to switch to insight practice for a while. If you're doing it out in life, then you can maybe do it while you're walking or being with them, or maybe go back when you're home and doing your practice. I'm going to bring that in. I'm going to invite that in. This is a powerful way to integrate our practice into our daily lives. I love to do this when I go for like a walk. I have a park nearby my house that's often fairly deserted. So I walk and I just kind of sit or walk with what's being elicited. Let me walk with this sense of arrogance. Let me walk with a sense of shame around it. Let me walk with a sense of being better than. And not trying to change or get rid of it, but kind of let it kind of be more fluid. And eventually by doing this, especially if you do it without adding more self-belief to it, at some point you just see it's just another belief and it actually lets go of you. Right? Does that help? Gave you a big assignment there, but... But yes, it's true, and that's a good honesty of seeing that. Oh wow, that's coming up, and that's the both the saving grace of this practice, but also kind of the in some ways a bummer because we can't really get away with anything.
Yeah. Well, part of it is my own trying. So when I see someone who's unhoused, right, I have discomfort with it, right?
Yeah.
So am I just covering that up by doing metta? Like, oh, well, this will make it all better. I'm doing something.
Yes.
But on the other hand, I am doing something. But...
Yeah, so. And any action is often going to be kind of mixed. It's like, okay, well, most of this is probably good. I'm going to keep doing it. You know, so there's going to be some, you know, some friction or some... If we waited till we're like 100% pure in everything we did, you know, we wouldn't be here, right? Yeah, so keep working with that. And that's, feel that, that's a little, okay, at least I'm doing something here. And maybe turn the metta toward yourself, okay? I'm uncomfortable. Metta turns toward that and it becomes compassion. Feel the discomfort about that. And when someone who's unhoused, it's intense, right? It can be an intense situation. And there's a lot of things that should elicit in us to see another human being. And we may not, you know, feel comfortable inviting them into our house, but we can still kind of open our heart to that experience. Yeah, it's a rich practice. Or anyone online like to ask or share anything? All right, go ahead, Eileen.
Hi, thank you, Tim. I'm not sure I want to share, but I decided to go ahead. On the one hand, I related very much to your story about the hospital. When I was in hospital about 8 years ago for surgery, the only way I could cope with it was doing metta for everybody in the ward and all the nurses and the orderlies. It was a great coping mechanism. I'm not sure, but I think that might be why the nurses tended to hang around in my room, even though they had nothing to do.
Probably.
It was probably, you know, attracting. On the other hand, when you started this meditation hour sitting earlier, and you said something about the warmth of the heart, I turned my attention to my heart, and it looked like a big chunk of marble, just hard as could be.
Yeah.
And there was no softness to it or whatever, and it kind of freaked me out that there's that kind of hardness. I don't know quite how to get from there to softening it up. If you have any thoughts about that, that would really help. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, first of all, thank you for sharing that experience of being in the hospital and how, you know, that place of being, you know, vulnerable, being, you know, all the crises and all the difficulty, that willingness to actually offer metta to those people around you. And then they probably did feel that, you know, that you weren't, you know, so cranky or actually having a care for them. And so the heart, so by saying that, I mean, how many of us do that? I mean, the heart is there, right? The heart is accessible. And so when we turn to metta and we feel, okay, there's just this block, there's this hardness or this place or granite, that's why sometimes that word loving kindness trips us up, right? I'm not feeling very loving right now. You know, so I can't do the practice. We get frustrated. So I think that's why I like to say that sense of friendliness, or even in a more neutral way, just that willingness to be next to, right? It's like sometimes occasionally when my wife and I get into some argument and we just like get hardened in our opinions, at some point we just sit next to each other. It's like, okay, I'm going to, I love you, but I'm not liking you right now, you know, but I'm willing to be next to. Right. So when you feel that block of heart, like that little phrase from Thomas Merton, that true love and prayer is learned in that hour when the heart, when prayer is impossible and the heart is turned to stone, or something like that. It's like, okay, the heart's stone here. And so that's like last month's parami, that sense of resolve. Okay, let me be with this. Let me open to that sense of that stoneness, that hardness of heart. And this is, I think, it's been so helpful in my own practice, is to realize that the thing itself might be too charged or too difficult to open to. And there may be a lot of resistance to it. But can I open to the resistance to opening to it? Can I just have a little, it's almost like a paper width difference of there's some allowance. And it might feel like it's way away. It's like, okay, the heart is stone. I don't want it to be here. I want it to be open and loving. Okay, can I allow the fact that I want it to be other than it is? Do you get a sense of that? You kind of back it up until there's a little bit of allowance, a little bit of softening, right? And so then there's a lot of patience. That's another parami, is this deep sense of patience, okay? This heart feels like stone right now, but you know from your history that it's not stone, right? Just right now it is, okay. And so let me just be in relationship to this. So warmth of heart, sometimes that really works. Sometimes it's not the right instructions. You know. So yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. We all go through phases of that when our heart has turned to stone, when things are difficult. And then maybe, yeah, switching to, you know, offering metta to whatever is possible in that moment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's an important question. Okay, Emery, let's go with you next, and we'll go back online or in room and see.
Yes, I wanted to ask a little bit of a question about Naomi Shihab Nye's poem and how she talks about sorrow and how sorrow is such an opening to kindness. And
it
can be a heart opener, you know, it can just kind of break you open a little bit and bring you closer to the kindness and closer to compassion and openness to the sorrow that is part of all people's lives and all humanity.
That's right.
But I'm also wondering, sometimes suffering can have the opposite quality, almost just what we were talking about. Like it can cause the heart to contract and frustration to happen and like, why is this happening? And so I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about the difference between suffering that leads to wisdom and suffering that keeps us in delusion. And what is the difference?
Sure. How much time do you have? Just a little question like that. Yeah, so the suffering that leads to more suffering, the suffering that leads to freedom, and there's this, for myself, it's often has to do with the suffering that leads to more suffering. There's kind of this subtle, almost subconscious overlay of, I don't want this to be the way it is. I want this moment to be different than it is. There's an argument with this moment. Right, so I mean, doesn't mean we don't have preferences. We don't want ourselves to be healthy and those who aren't us to be healthy. But there's this kind of like, I just don't want this to be this way. It could be a very subtle quality, but that tends to kind of make things perpetuate. It kind of makes the suffering more intense because we're really arguing, resisting, fighting that moment. And times when I drop that resistance, often that's when some of the big things are like, okay, I just can't manage this anymore. This is too big for me to try to manage. It's like something in me surrenders to it and opens to it. That's when that heart opens. That's when things relax, you know, because we're not resisting. It's a paradox, right? We're trying to keep the suffering at bay. We're trying to keep it from overwhelming us. We're trying to manage it and control it. And yet that, when it's embedded with this, not that deep, subtle quality of not allowing, then that tends to perpetuate it. So I'm going to just let myself fall apart. Let things just, you know, and these are hard times, right? There's a time I realize, two times to come to mind, there was this, actually back to this scenario with my wife, is I was outside and just, okay, I don't know how this is going to be. And there was this something relaxed in me. I knew I still had to manage. I still had to deal with everything that had to be dealt with, the daughter and medical, all that stuff. But there's this falling away. And there's another time when I had some very difficult experience. And just the dukkha was just kind of churning and churning and churning. And at some point it's like, okay, I can't. This is just not working. The suffering is just becoming unbearable. And at some point there's this, okay, it kind of blew open the resistance. The resistance fell away to that suffering. And there was peace with that. This is actually, it's interesting. Two modern meditative masters or spiritual teachers, Byron Katie and Eckhart Tolle, both had similar histories of just deep depression, deep personal pain. And then at some point they opened to it in a way that transcended everything. And there's a deep peace from that. So it's tricky, right? And it could be like this opening, and then the next moment you're resisting and trying to get rid of it. But you just start to incline yourself toward it. And for myself, part of it is that non-resistance. What I find also is a big key is the container, which I'm trying to hold it, is often too small. Like if it feels so personal and I feel like I can't share it, if I can find some way to expand the container so it becomes not just me holding it, it could be with some dear friends, it could be with a therapist. I like to also work with nature. Like I go out and just let that grief, that fear, that pain, like, okay, I'm going to just let it spread out through nature. If I can, I go someplace and I can just fall apart in nature. Because nature could hold all the grief, all the sadness without flinching. Right? It just opens to it, accepts it. And that somehow teaches me a way of that quality too. Even though this is intense pain, I can open to it. And finally, just reflecting on the commonality of this. Of this pain, you know, that it's a shared one. And this is a classic sutta, I think it's called the mustard seed. Well, it's about the mustard seed. So basically this woman lost her child and was so overcome with grief, she wasn't willing to let go of that the child was carrying it around, asking for help, cure my child. And finally, people directed her to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, okay, we can help this situation, but you have to find a mustard seed from a house who has never lost someone. So she went to house after house after house, and they offered her mustard seeds, but each house had lost someone in that their family. And she realized after enough, oh, other people have lost. This is a human condition, and her grief loosened up. And so these are some of the times when there are difficult times in our life, difficult parts of our practice. But having that quality of patience with it, that quality of from last month, you know, that quality of perseverance, and eventually it starts to loosen up. And those moments often teach us very deep things. And some of it's the timing. Sometimes we just need to really care for the pain of that. Yeah, so not to jump over the pain without, you know, taking care of ourselves. All right, some big questions here. Anyone else like to ask or share anything? How about here in the room, online? Austin, let's bring the mic over so they can hear you online.
Thank you, Tim, for a great talk. And I'll start off with saying I don't know. And I met a Salish, I think is the language, Native woman, in Eastern Washington. And we were just talking about millennia of Native people living in these lands in the quote-unquote wilderness before there was just the wilderness was destroyed. And I asked her how for millennia they navigated their way with so many dangers, you know, snakes and bears and things. And her answer stuck with me. She said that, well, this was our neighborhood, and it's kind of like in your neighborhood. You know where there's a dangerous area. And so you go around, right? You learn that. So when you were sharing about metta in that way and joking about the bear versus the butterflies,
right?
You know, it all in an ironic way, it illustrated for me that metta is not always like this defenseless posture.
That's right.
That actually it's wishing well for the bear, because if the bear's well, they won't eat me. And so, I don't know, I just felt that it was ironic that it kind of made me think that the metta is not weakness in a sense.
That's right. Yeah, the metta has, you know, in some ways it's there's this real strength because it's coming from a place of interconnection. And it doesn't lose its clarity either. It doesn't lose its discernment. Like, I love that. Okay, you just know the neighborhood, you know, you know where the bear hangs out. I mean, Sharon Salzberg has so many great stories, but she was in Asia in a like a rickshaw or something, and some drunkard guy wanted to pull her off and assault her, and she was able to beat him off. And her teacher, he told her teacher about it, and her teacher said, "Oh, Sharon, with all the loving kindness in your heart, you should have hit him over the head with your umbrella." So, so that's sometimes that's what's needed. You know, we can have these forceful actions, but it's like our heart can still be engaged in that. There can still be this willingness, this wish for the person's or bear's well-being. Yeah. Thank you, Austin. All right. Anyone else? We have a couple more minutes. No pressure, but it's often nice to flesh out the talk and the topic. All right, everyone good? Oh, yes, go ahead, Charles.
What you said just made me think of some of the Thai forest Ajahns, some of the great monks one of them, Ajahn Chah, I think, was very tough on his students. He would often, you know, step on their feet and yell at them for just slacking off or something like that. And one of his students said that that was also a form of metta, because he was looking out for them. He wanted what's best for them. Mm. So I just thought that was interesting with the umbrella.
That's right. Yeah, metta, yeah, it's like there, especially when a teacher and student, they have a, there's a level of commitment, a level of, okay, I'm really in this to go as deeply as I can. It can be that expression of metta, you know, being more, it may feel like harsh or may feel like there's an edge to it. And, you know, so it's tricky though, you know, it's tricky because if it's held in that perspective, okay, this teacher is here taking care of me or has my best interest at heart, then it can be received. But sometimes maybe it's not received in the right way. So that's an interesting story. So you think I should walk around and step on people's feet? Like in the Zen tradition, there's the, I forget the name of it, but they have the stick, you know. So someone walks around and hits people. But it's often, I've talked to a Zen person, and it's something that you ask, you bow, you lean forward, and it kind of brings more energy. So it's like there's that, you know, asking for that energy. So, but we're not planning on doing that anytime soon. All right, anyone else? Okay. I can see there you go. All right, so next week we'll have a chance to explore this topic. We'll go do a short talk, kind of a recap of this, and then we'll see how what you've learned about metta in action. How does it show up? How is it an antidote to fear, to anger, to anxiety? All right, so look forward to hearing from you next week, and may you be well, whatever this week holds for you. Thank you. All right, goodbye, everyone online.